Welcome to the Been There, Done That podcast with Angela Dunn Cartledge.
Hi, everybody. This is Angela Dunn Cartledge. This is the Been There, Done That podcast. And we have a wonderful guest today. Mark Medding is here, author. I can't wait to have this conversation. So thank you so much for making the time today, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Oh, happy to be here and really, really, really nice to talk with you. You're a joy to speak to. So
thank you. My goal today is just to be able to talk through your journey, how you got here as the author of your exciting book. I haven't read it yet, but I can't wait to. It sounds really, 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 really interesting. So tell our audience a little bit about yourself, how you got here, and then we can kind of build the conversation from there.
How I got here. Wow.
That's a big question, right?
You just have a couple of days to listen to that.
Right, exactly.
Oh boy. Well, you know, I grew up in the 70s. I was born in 67. Grew up in that era of, you know, time where things were a little bit different, you know. I grew up in a loving family. You know, I also grew up in a family where, you know, you didn't talk about how you felt. You didn't talk about, you know, it was almost like that kind of, you know, children should be seen, not heard, or whatever, right? That's right. Silly. Yeah. But my family life was, it wasn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, I could easily focus on that if I want, but I choose to focus on the good stuff. And there was a lot of good stuff. I mean, my parents did the best they could. Yeah. And, you know, I was a good kid. I was a respectful young lad. And I was a little crazy.
Yeah.
My parents, I was the last of three. So I was the youngest. And, there was a lot of drama around my older brother. It was pretty serious stuff that was going on. So not to say that, you know, I was left to my own devices, but I was left to my own devices. And, yep. You know, when you're young like that and going through, you know, in those formidable years, you figure out one thing. Right. And it's either you're going to sink or you're going to swim, and that's it. And like, I'm a survivor 100%. And I chose to survive. So I jumped into life and said, well, whatever it is, I'm going to make sure that, you know, I'm taking care of myself. And I had to, you know, my father was an alcoholic, and my, mother was very depressed by a lot of the stuff that went on in her family and stuff. She did the best she could, but she was on to the robot, very robotic. But, you know, she showed her love by, you know, making sure food was on the table and the house was clean, and picked me up from soccer practice and drove me to my girlfriend's house. And, you know, that was her love language, was that. And, you know, through high school, I got very into alcohol and drugs when I was younger, and even in my adult life. And I got pretty crazy when I was younger. And then we lost my mother. And I know that this is about, you know, this is about dealing with death and that kind of thing. And, that time of my life where I was really kind of, I was completely lost, to be honest with you. I was... Mm-hmm. Graduated high school barely. I was more interested in partying and carrying on and anything outside of education.
And you were, I don't mean to interrupt you, you were a teenager when she passed, right? You were still in high school when she passed?
No, just outside.
Okay.
I was 21, 22. I want to say, just turned 22, I think.
Okay.
So I was out of school, and, you know, we weren't getting along so well at the time. I was struggling with figuring out life and things like that. And she died suddenly. It was really terrible. It was really awful. She got cancer. Yeah, it was one of those things. It was like, and I was so wrapped up in my own head and my own life. And you're 22 years old. You think your parents are going to live on forever, and you don't think about death. At least I didn't.
Right.
And my mother passed away suddenly. It was she went in for she had gotten cancer, and back then they didn't have the cancer technologies that they do today. So like there wasn't really vehicles. I mean, not to say that there wasn't, but it wasn't as prominent. Like vehicles for early detection weren't really.
Yes, that's what I was going to say too. Not even education was involved. I mean, it was just, I don't feel good. I guess I'll go to the doctor kind of thing. Absolutely.
Yeah,
Yeah.
eventually it's unbearable, and you're
Right.
like, and it's already
Right.
too late. So,
Right. Right.
and doctors were misdiagnosing her and all kinds of stuff. So it was one of those weird situations. So she went in for, my mother went in for surgery, and didn't really think much of it. Again, a stupid 22-year-old kid. I didn't know anything about life. I thought I did, but I was just a dumb kid. And she was going in for surgery, and I was like, all right, whatever. And she never made it out. She ended up having a full-on stroke and massive stroke, and ended up on a life support, and she was gone. And 4 days later, we had to make the decision of whether to keep her on life support or not. We chose not to. And it was such a crazy time, because my sister was having the first grandchild of the family. And all my mother and my sister really, were very, very close. And this was a big deal. Huge, huge deal for the family, for everybody. I was excited. Everybody was excited. We're going to have a new baby, right? And my sister was in her, I want to say, like maybe 7.5 months, 8 months, 7, 8 months along. So she was really in a dangerous spot when my mother died. And just a devastating blow to everybody. And but it's interesting. I think we shared about this a little bit when we talked weeks ago, that even though that was one of the most, I guess, intense experiences I've had, my approach to death at the time was kind of very accepting, right out of the gate. I mean, the day of her funeral, like I actually performed the eulogy for my mother, which was I also performed the eulogy for my dad. It's interesting. I guess I'm the eulogy guy. I
You are a great speaker, so that might be why, but there's a strength there, right? That is maybe assumed, but there's a strength there that other people see. So for sure.
You
For
bring
sure.
that up. That's really, I appreciate you saying that, because I felt like, even though I was kind of the youngest and whatever, I also felt like I was the strongest in the family. And I almost felt like an anchor in a way, even though I was, young and, a silly kid. But my father was devastated, and everybody was. But I didn't fall apart. I think I cried for a short time, and I'm not saying that that's healthy. I'm just saying that that's what it was, and that's my approach to it. I mean, I remember the day after her, she passed. I went down to the rec field with a basketball, and I was just shooting hoops for like an hour, and that was just my way of kind of like processing what the hell just happened. Like, I wasn't the person that was going to sit downstairs in the basement and ball. That wasn't me. My friends had to go. My friends found me. My friends were like, what are you doing? They found me at the rec field shooting hoops. And they were like, why? What are you doing? Your mom died. That was just my means of coping and processing things. And interestingly enough, though, and I always like to bring this up when I talk about my story, because even though I was completely lost, and we always talk about death as you know, such a profoundly negative thing, and lives, right? And at the time, I would agree. At the time, that was an insanely negative situation. But looking back, it was also the most life-changing for me positively, because when all that happened, I realized, okay, I got to get my act together here. Like, you know, it's time. It's time. Enough of this floundering, whatever. I ended up going to school, went to like a technical school just to get something under my belt, and ended up in a career that I'm still in today. So I look back on that time of my life with my mother and I go, you know, that was horrific and, you know, just such a devastating, but it also ended up being the most positive thing that ever happened to me. So it's like, you know, when you think about divine providence, right? And you think about being able to pull anything good out of a very bad situation, right? Yeah. And that I believe in divine providence. I always have. I learned that early on in my life, thank God, through, believe it or not, Wayne Dyer. The seed was planted, and he spoke of that in his Power of Intention. It was a very popular thing back then. Power of Intention. I listened to it on cassette tape. That's how I'm dating myself now. And it changed my life. It really did. Being able to look at things differently. And, you know, he always said, if you change the way you look at things, the things that you look at will change.
Love
Right.
it. Love
Yeah.
it. Such a
And then,
shift in perspective, right? I mean, because I don't mean to interrupt your story because I want to keep talking and get to your book and those amazing things. But what's amazing to me about hearing you say that is that what I know from my family's journey of alcoholism and what you and I have already talked about is that there's this uniqueness that you feel. There's this piece of you that feels like you're the only one that is struggling. You're the only one that has this problem, whatever this problem is, and that you're using your life has to have a way to resolve itself somehow. And so that by shifting your perspective like that, not only were you saying, I'm not going to listen to that part of my brain anymore. I'm not going to let you tell me that I have to keep drinking, that I have to keep doing whatever that is. I'm gonna do this other thing instead. I'm gonna completely change and flip the script. I love that so much.
yeah, no matter how you look at it. And you know, we do feel, you know, I think some of us suffer from terminal uniqueness. You know, we feel like, oh, our story is the most, you know, unique story ever. And then you find out that, you know, it's really not, you know, it's my story, you know, and it's unique, and it, you know, it's mine, but it doesn't necessarily make it any different than anybody else's. You know, if I threw my story out on the table and 10 other people threw their stories out on the table, I probably would take mine back and go, I'm good.
Yeah, I like mine best. Yeah, I'm okay. Yeah.
All good here. You guys keep your stories.
Exactly.
But yeah, so it was from that perspective, you know, it was I'd like to say that my you know, my drinking and carrying on subsided, but it didn't. I stopped getting arrested. That was probably a really good thing. You know,
Very
things
good
like
thing.
that. Yeah, that was good. It's definitely a positive in my life, you know, stopping getting in trouble. And then but you know, I ended up getting a career and yeah, marriage and kids and all that kind of stuff along the way. And you know, I can't say that my ride from that point forward was smooth. Far from it. I'm on my third marriage. That should probably be an indication of where I was at. But you know, it took a while for me to go through the process to get to where I'm at today, you know. And there was a lot in that journey. And you know, to be honest with you, as much as I'd love to say, no, I'd go back and change this, if where I sit today, if I had to go through all of that all every single day of it, every hour of it, every ounce of it, whatever, to get to where I'm at today, and probably the most beautiful place I've ever been in my life, then I wouldn't change a single thing. You know?
That's the thing, is that it's about the journey, right? I mean, that's ultimately what we're trying to say, is that you wouldn't be here if it weren't for that. You wouldn't have had the middle if it weren't for the beginning. And that is such a cool thing to realize, that awareness that you didn't have when you were 22, that you can absolutely look back and be able to see that. I think that's so powerful and so profound and important to be able to say that. When we talked the first time, when we talked in our first conversation a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the fact that your book probably wouldn't have been written had you
Wow.
not had your middle or beginning. You know, that wouldn't have gotten to here in terms of this, the reason that we even know each other wouldn't be here because of that. So that's cool that this connection was able to be made by nature of the way your story has progressed. And so I just think that's a cool, it's a cool way to look at it. And again, going back to your terminal uniqueness kind of concept, yes, you're right. There are threads of all of our stories that we can connect, that's how we can connect to each other. It's an easy way to do that, but it's still you and your perspective, the thing you experienced, that is the most important thing. How many years between your mother passing did your father pass?
Oh, my mother passed away in 1989. My father passed in 2014.
Oh, quite a difference. Okay.
Oh,
What
yeah.
do you what do you do to try and alleviate that closure? How did you get to here where you could feel like you had that closure and you were able to say, I have to move on from that. I can't stay here and think, hey, I'm never going to get to say these things to my mom. Those
Well, if you don't mind, it's kind of a two-parter for me to
Okay.
answer. So
Love it.
there was some resentment that I was dealing with my mother. You know, you go through life and you start to blame your parents for your life and things and whatever, and you get into your 30s and your 40s, and it's like everyone else's fault, and you know, and then finally you start to realize, you know, I got to a point in my life where I had to let go of all that stuff. You know, I had to let go of, you know, and just realize that my parents did the best they could, whether it was good, bad, or indifferent, it didn't matter.
Absolutely.
And you know, I turned a corner with all of that, letting go of resentments and any kind of feelings, because it doesn't matter at this point. So how do I deal with that? So I make a point to bring my mother flowers at her grave, and my father, they're buried together. But I never used to go to the cemetery, never used to want to. And my shtick was always, well, if I want to think about my mother, I could do it anywhere. I don't need to be sitting there staring at a headstone, right? That was kind of my deal. But my way now of appreciating my mother and respecting my mother and my father and my grandparents. We lived with them. My grandparents were downstairs. We were upstairs. So we were in the
Very
mother's room.
fun.
And like I make I you know they went out of their way for me. I can go out of my way for them. Right now, their cemetery is not that close. It's about just under an hour away. So it's kind of, you know, kind of an undertaking to get there, but not a big. But you know, I would go once a year. You know, holiday, Thanksgiving, I'd go drop off some flowers. My mother loved flowers. And so I'd go down and but now I go down more frequently. And because I want to, because I feel like she deserves that. And it took a while, I gotta be honest. And you know, again, we go back to our, you know, what, look what you've done to me, to, you know what, look what I did to them, right? Forget about the crap that my brother put them through, and my sister even, and myself, and yeah, you forget. And they struggled with their own. You know, my mother was clinically depressed, and you know, we know that now that that's you know, I used to look at that as, you know, differently, because I used to look at her on the couch, and she'd have no emotion, And I just thought that she was just cold and, you know.
Right, removed, right? Not present. She was not engaging in life and all of that, not knowing that she didn't have a choice. She didn't feel like she did anyway. Yeah.
That's it. And, you know, now, like the theme of life, you see these bumper stickers and shirts, and people are saying, you know, be kind. You never know what another person is dealing with, right? And, you know, it's really easy to look at my mother sitting out there on the couch being, you know, lifeless, and my father drinking his life away and passing out, to go, you know, oh, and judge them, right? Could easily sit there and judge them. Or you could go, my God, what were they going through? Right? What were they
Right.
dealing with? Right? So who
Because
am
you
I?
weren't, this goes back to your comment about we didn't talk about stuff like that. Like that wasn't stuff that we said. Yeah, there wasn't a conversation that you could have to get there. You were never going to get that clarity. So that's.
There was never even a crack in the door to sit and have that dialogue. There was never, you know, what are you going through right now? How are you feeling? What's going on? That would be like, you know, forget it. It never, like
And
that con.
likewise, I feel like that's likewise why you felt removed from it also, why you felt like there wasn't, you know, there was not a connection there too, because you didn't have the opportunity to open the door to anybody else either. You know, there wasn't anything you could learn from that. So, yeah.
And I learned that, God, at age 5, I think. So I realized that my mother was was in the condition that she was. And I said, but I didn't know like that it was, you know, clinical depression or anything. I just knew that, okay, she's not the one that's going to come up and give me a big hug and tell me she loves me. If I want that, I gotta go get it from her. So what would I do? I would find ways that I would be able to get that response from her. So I would pick up flowers and leave them on a table. I would go down and pick up a card and leave it on the dining room table and let her find it. And then I would get a hug. You know, I would find ways to get her to the point where it would be completely inappropriate for her not to say something. You know, like,
Right.
right?
Make her.
So I was like, all right, well, if you're not going to give it to me, well, I'm going to get it one way or another, right? So again, it was like sink or swim, right? So, all right, I'm not going to be. So that was my approach to connecting with my mother. I had to go and get it. That's a horrible way as a kid to have to grow up, but you know, that carried out in various ways in my life, in relationships and things like that. And you know, I it just it took a while for me to be able to even come to even understand that, to even like realize that's what the connection of how I am in relationships to how I was set up. Okay, if I'm trying to get something from, you know, a feeling from somebody, I know how to do it. You
You
know,
had to
I
produce it. Yeah, you had to somehow produce it somehow.
Right. And that's how it was. And you know, again, my mother's love language was different. So, you know, I know without a question in my mind that she loved me. And there was no question, right? But there was no emotion behind it. There was no like, so, and my father was exactly the opposite. My father was more the believe it or not, he was more the what do you call it? Affectionate and more, you know, would, you know, grab me, hug me, and, you know, tell me he loved me. Funny. It's so different, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. I mean, it's all part of the dynamic, right? I mean, it's all part of what creates the mark that we're talking to today. And that, to me, what's fascinating about that is that even you're calling it sink or swim, but I also look at it as a grief of what you thought was going to come. You know, you may have been grieving the loss of her long time before you actually lost her, is my own thought about it. That because you had lost her, you didn't have that nurturing relationship that you really needed as a kid and wanted and that kind of thing. How does that piece, how does that lack of nurturing then play into writing a book? How does that come into Mark's world and become part of something that you wanted to do? How did you get to that point?
That's a great question. And I think, again, I think I have to go back just a little bit to a point where when I was talking about earlier, where I got to a point where I didn't want to hang on to this. So like that, what we just talked about that whole thing with my mother, I held her responsible for a lot of crap that went on in my life. And I also was resentful about it. I didn't truly understand it. I wasn't able to still, even in my adult life, it was blame, 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 and not take a second and really look at the bigger picture and right and understand what she was going through. Once I was able to do that and get into a place of forgiveness was huge. Let me tell you what, absolutely huge. When I turned the corner on being mad at her or resentful about my life or whatever, my upbringing, and let that go and truly move on and have respect for her and what she went through, I wouldn't have had the clarity because all of that resentment and all of that garbage, that bad feeling was in the way of so many things in my life, you know. And over the course of time, I've managed to clean house and, you know, do the things that I've needed to become a better Mark. And one of the things was, you know, I had to do some deep forgiveness on my brother. Massive, even bigger than my mother and father. I didn't think that that would ever be possible. And there it is. And the thing about forgiveness is it's not for the other person, right? It's for
Right.
us, it's for
Right.
me. If I truly want to be free, if I truly want to be free and open and able to receive, I got to let go of all that stuff. I got to be able to forgive the other person so that I can clear out all that junk and be able to receive and let people in, you know? And be able
Yeah.
to have good, solid, really, really meaningful relationships. So I bring that up because if I hadn't gone through the phases and the work to let go of the resentments, to forgive, truly forgive, there's no way in the world that
You can say hell, it's all right.
there's no way in hell that this would have ever happened. I just because I would have been blocked by all the junk. I would have been blocked by all the, you know, lots of distractions.
It holds you back, right? Like it's almost like an obstacle in the way of you reaching your dreams and your goals because it's literally a big boulder sitting there keeping you from getting there. I've been there. I've
Couldn't
been there,
be
friend.
more spot on. And you know, and there's people in my life that do not understand my approach to truly letting go and because you know what? I don't want that poison inside me anymore.
That's exactly what I was going to say is that that's that I've heard that old phrase, the old saying, holding a grudge is giving yourself poison and expecting the other person to die. That's exactly what you feel like you're describing, right? That it's that you think you're protecting yourself from whatever that junk was, but in all honesty, you're protecting yourself from anything, good, bad, medium, you know, whatever that looks like, you're keeping yourself from moving forward at all. And that is, it's so real. And
Oh, yeah.
then by nature of the other behavior was that you actually were poisoning yourself as a result of these horrible feelings that you had about yourself, about whatever else was going on. You were doing that and You were holding the grudge. So I can't even imagine the amount of pain that you were feeling. That had to have been pretty big.
have no idea.
Yeah. And now for you to say you're at the most beautiful point in your life, that's a big statement based on what you've described. That's why I love having these conversations with people, because it is so giant to be able to say, I'm at the best place in my life now, and I wouldn't trade all of that. But listening to all of that, everybody would think, of course you would trade all of that. Yuck. How would you not? And that's what's beautiful about it, is that you can't, because it wouldn't be here if it weren't for that stuff. So yeah, it's all part of the same journey.
Going through all that was
Yeah.
absolutely. And you know, I just want to point out that my life right now today, although I like to refer to it as beautiful, is far from perfect. I mean, I have strained relationships with my children. You know, there's lots of things, but the beauty is an outside, right? The beauty that I feel is inside me. So it's in me. So whatever's going on outside of is, you know, is what it is. It doesn't define, you know, do I have feelings? Of course I do. But, you know, I also have a lot of hope and a lot of you know, whatever. But you know, that's the thing about you know, finding peace inside, finding some form of peace inside, is that everyone thinks it's this external, I'm gonna grab for this, I'm gonna do that. I'm going to find this over here, and all of these things are going to bring me peace, not realizing that it is 100% an inside job. I mean, if you don't deal with that stuff, if you don't take care of that stuff and let go of resentments, and you're never going to have peace. It's never going to happen, right?
I love that. And that, to the peace part, is what is so critical. That's what I find myself saying so often, is I just want peace. And that's the work, right? That's the work, is to continue to get to a place where you feel peace most of the time. It's not going to be all the time, because that's not how life works, but it'll at least be most of the time. And even 95% of the time, feeling peace would be an ideal I hope to achieve someday. So I think there's just a lot. I totally agree with that. And for me, the letting go part is also about forgiving yourself for the pieces that you're responsible for, because you can look back and say, there were pieces of this that I did. It was my action. It was my, I guess, acting out. But I mean, I did it too. I had my own ways of battling outward instead of battling inward. It was too painful to look at what I had thought about and what I had possibly contributed to the mess. So it was easy, way easier to just say it was everybody else that was the problem. And that then you, when you really dig in and you really start to look at, yeah, but control the controllables. Look at the parts that you actually can do something about and ignore the rest. And then you're going to see clearly that, oh, yeah, there were some actions in there that I participated in, but I didn't have to actually take that on. And that's, I have always wanted to write a book, always since I was a little girl. I was the friend, kind of like the friend in Stand By Me, that would tell the stories, and they would, and everybody would go, I'm sleepy, but I can't fall asleep. Tell me a story. That would be me. And so I would be making up stories all the time. And I have for my whole life. I've always been making up stories and writing them down and keeping up with them and all those kinds of things. But I've never taken the leap. But I really want to hear how you allowed yourself to do it, how you allowed yourself to sit down and commit to writing the book. And I want you to tell everybody what the book is about and all of those things too. But I really want to know how you dug in within yourself to say, yeah, this is what I want to do. This is what I'm led to do.
The inspiration of the story really kind of ties in with a lot of what we were talking about. Because all right, so before I go any further with that, it might be a good segue to just I'm just going to read the synopsis of the book. Is that okay?
Perfect. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's perfect.
And
Perfect.
it'll make sense about what I'm about to say. So this is a story about four friends who grew up together in rural N North Jersey. The four are close enough to be brothers, chosen family, whose loyalty and love for one another becomes a powerful force in their lives growing up. But when the boys witness a tragic accident befall a local police officer, they are severely impacted, especially upon learning the full extent of the injury. As the boys witness the impact of the tragedy on their friend's wife and family, they create a pact. If any one of the boys should ever become a mental or physical burden to their friends or family, the remaining friends need to end their life. Decades later, once the boys grow up to be men, they are devastated to learn that due to a horrible accident, one of them meet the conditions that had been described in the pact. The remaining friends connect with one another and set off on a journey to get to their soul brother to fulfill their fateful obligation. A compelling, frequently funny story about reconnection, friendship, and love that asks the question, can the boys fulfill the pact and murder their friend this many years later and with so much to lose? So that's the story. That's what the story is all about. And those first couple of sentences, the story is about four friends who grew up together in rural North Jersey, four, right, becomes a powerful force in their lives growing up. I just want to touch on that because that's true. This story was spawned from a pact that my friends and I had made back when we were younger, 14, 15, something like that. And those friends that I grew up with at the time, so we talked a lot about my mom and my growing up earlier in this segment. And I gotta tell you that if it wasn't for these friends, that like little island that I could go to that was safe and powerful, and there was just, there was just love and adventure and exploring and friendship, and we looked out for each other. It was just and it was such a special time. So the book idea came from that. So once I had that, laid out, it was kind of like just go, right? So I drew from the book is fiction, even though there's it's inspired, right, by real events. It's a fiction book, so the characters are all fictitious, even though there's little pieces of my friends in each of the characters. So it's not one character that is one particular friend. It's a blend, and even the events that took place, even though they're somewhat kind of drew from real life, they're fictitious as well. But there's a lot of comedy in the book, even though the undertone of the book and the title, The Jersey Death Squad, A Journey to Kill Jesse Freeman, could freak people out and go, what the hell is this? And then about love and connection and friendship going, wait, you're going to kill your friend and he's your buddy? What are you talking about? Like,
I had sort of read the synopsis and was like, I'm so glad that this book is about what it's about. I love the concept of friendship that is that connected, that is so powerful that it is a brotherly concept, that you do anything for each other, you've got each other's backs, you're always together. That kind of concept is just it's a cool fascination to me to understand that kind of friendship.
oh, I've had conversations with women that have read my book, and they're friendly, they're friends of mine, and I said, so, forget the fact that we're friends, and like, tell me, like, did the book speak to you? And even though it's very male oriented, there's a lot of cursing in it. The language is very male oriented, a lot of adult language in there, but what I loved about what a couple of them have said is, like, even though I couldn't relate to the male, ball busting, I could, it took me back to my relationships when I was a kid. And I was like, that's exactly what I wanted from this. I want people to reflect on that time of what their relationships meant to them back then, how they've evolved. Maybe they're still best friends with those people from kindergarten. You know, there's some people that I know that have relationships with friends. I have friends of mine that I'm still in touch with that I've known since the third grade. I mean, one of my friends that is kind of depicted as one of the characters in this book is I mean, I truly love this guy. And he and I love a couple of my friends, but this one particular guy, I've known him for a long, long time, and we're still in touch. You know, we're not getting together every weekend and you know whatever, but the
It's not
very
like it was when you were 14 and 15, right? It's, but yeah.
finding each other every day. There's some really fun, there's some fun adventures because the journey really is spent with the boys having to go leave New Jersey to go to their friend who was living in Colorado. So the journey starts when they get in the car and they set out to go to Colorado to get to their friend so they can, you know, fulfill the terms of the pact, right? Even though they have no idea what they're going to do when they get there, which is really funny. And they even talk about that in the book. And like, and then it's like, and then there's adventures that of course happen along the way, you know, like there's just things that, you know, it's a long drive. So there's just, you know, some cool, funny adventures. And then there's flashbacks to back when they were growing up, and there's anecdotes, and there's also, so those anecdotes go back to that time where you see the bond form, right? So even though it starts out in their adult life with them finding each other, getting in the car and going, the flashbacks bring you back to the time when they were creating the bonds and creating the connection and creating the loyalty to each other. And one of the interviews I've been on, they asked me to summarize the book in one word. And the only word that I could come up with is love. And
That's
again,
great.
we laughed at that. He laughed at that. He's like, the Jersey Death Squad, a journey to
It's a book about love, right?
but again, that's kind of the satirical approach I took to this was I wanted it to kind of be so profound of a title, but when you read it, you go, oh my God, this is like a dark comedy. It's like, and then it kind of like, then the title actually becomes more funny because it's not anything that you think it's going to be. But I wanted it to like come out and kind of punch you right in the face.
Don't worry, sir. You achieved your goal in both ways. You both achieved the goal of a punch you in the face title and a title that intrigued you to the point that you read it, that you pick it up and go, wait a second, this can't be what I think it is. And that's exactly what it is. I really love the concept of it, and I think that it is, I can't wait to dig into it some more. So, I'm really, really excited for that. So,
Just a really quick note. I'm very excited. My book has made it to number 24 on Amazon. I'm a top 100 seller now.
look at
And
you. You really
yeah,
are. You're a top 25 for that.
that was as of today. We hit under 25, and I'm going for number one. So
Fantastic.
if you're intrigued at all by this story, and it's a short read. It's not a long read. It's kind of a short book. It's not very long. It's on Kindle, it's in paperback, and it is on Audible.
Excellent.
So
Do you
you
read it or did somebody else read it for you?
oh, I had a narrator. I had a narrator
Nice.
that really gave Scotty life. Kind of think Sopranos meets Stand By Me kind of thing. And
That's
the narrator.
exactly the way I pictured it. I'm so excited to hear you say that because that's exactly the way I pictured the story. So it's perfect.
By me before, and I was like, oh, she's onto it. She's good. So the characters are from North Jersey, so they got a lot of, you know, hey, forget about it. You know what I mean? Oh, hey, doing over there? What's wrong? Oh, like that kind of thing. But yet there's that stance sort of like, so Scotty, who narrates the book, who narrates the story in the book, is one of the characters. And I needed somebody to kind of have that, kind of like Tony Soprano kind of thing, if you're a Sopranos fan, that be able to like really like you almost had to, otherwise it wouldn't make sense. And this guy, Anthony Ziello, I found this guy on as a professional narrator, and man, he just nailed it perfectly. I just wait till you hear
That's
it. Even
awesome.
if you get a chance to listen to the soundbite, it's just hilarious. He's fantastic.
Oh, I will for sure. I love Audible books. I want to close out with, I've really been thinking about your starting point. And I don't mean the day that you were born or whatever, but to me, I sort of see your starting point as being when your mom passed away. And if you could go back to talk to Mark that day and tell him anything about whatever you want to tell him, I'll let you decide what that message would be. What would you tell him about what is coming, what he needs to know about where he is right then, whatever? What would you tell him?
What would I tell young?
Yes.
I would tell Mark, it's going to be okay. You're going to be okay. Settle down. easy.
Right. Yeah.
I didn't like myself. I certainly didn't love myself. I don't think I was capable at the time. So I would try to convince him to, but boy, oh boy, that Mark wouldn't have heard it. He wouldn't have listened. He would have been, he thought he knew everything, and he knew nothing. He knew nothing at all. Complete clueless kid. So I guess that's about all I could think, that I would just kind of like say, you know what, just easy. It's going to be okay. You don't have to be. I was on the run. I was on the run constantly until probably 8 years ago, maybe even 6 years ago. And until I was able to stop running. And I, maybe that's what I would probably say now that I think about it. I'd say, stop running. It's okay. Be still. But I don't know that. I don't know that young Mark would have been able to.
Right. I love the message, even if young Mark would have even heard that. But I'm not going to say old Mark as a counterbalance to young Mark. I'm going to say new Mark
New Mark.
knows that there would be value in that message. So that's all I care about. So
Well, yeah.
thank you for all of your time, for all of this. This has
Loved it.
been, I did too. This has been really, really great. And I can't wait to see the book hit number one and what comes out of Mark Metting next, because
Yeah.
I have a feeling the Jersey Death Squad is not all of it. So there's got to be more in there.
Getting warmed up.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Okay, cool.
I wish you a lot of luck with this,
Thank
and
you.
I have to say, I don't know you from Adam, but you're a lovely host, and tell you put off such a wonderful, lovely vibe.
So that just means that we could have another conversation. That's what that means.
Have a part two. Oh
Yeah,
my,
exactly.
my
I love
nose
it.
out of that.
Thank you so much again for your time, for being vulnerable, for being honest. I really appreciate it. And we'll definitely have a part two for sure.
And please feel free to stay in touch.
I
And
will for sure. You also.
thank you again.
Thank you, Mark.